If I asked you to point on a map to the state with the absolute highest concentration of Danish ancestry today, you'd probably point to a dairy farm in Wisconsin, or maybe, somewhere in Minnesota.
Right, yeah, that's the assumption.
But you'd be wrong.
Completely wrong.
The actual answer is Utah. Almost 4% of the state claims Danish heritage.
Which is just, I mean, it completely defies that standard prairie pioneer stereotype most people hold in their heads.
It totally blows it out of the water.
Yeah.
So today we are taking a deep dive into this massive 2026 report. It's called Scandinavians in America.
Yeah, and it's based on incredibly granular 2024 U.S. Census Bureau data, the American Community Survey stuff.
Exactly. Okay, let's unpack this because our mission today is to move way beyond the cliched image of, stoic farmers eating lutefisk in a blizzard.
Right.
We want to uncover the complex historical, geographic, and, well, the political realities of how 1.3 million immigrants radically shaped the modern United States.
And we should probably define our terms right in the top here.
Oh, definitely.
For the purposes of this specific report, the term Scandinavian strictly means people from Norway, Sweden, and Denmark.
So not the broader category.
Exactly. It's a narrower ethno-historical definition compared to Nordic, which would include Finns and Icelanders.
Gotcha.
Now, we will touch on Finnish immigrants a bit later. Their history in mining and labor organizing deeply intersects with the Scandinavian story, especially in the upper Midwest and the Pacific Northwest.
Right.
But our primary focus is really that Norwegian, Swedish, and Danish triad.
And to you listening, whether you have Nordic roots yourself, or maybe you live in a Midwestern town surrounded by old brick Lutheran churches, or if you're just fascinated by how human migration literally builds a country's infrastructure, this deep dive really
It
matters.
really does.
Because we are going to see exactly how this historical data translates into the towns, the local politics, and just the culture you interact with every single day.
Yeah, but to understand that map of 2024, we actually had to look at the pressure cooker of mid-19th century Europe.
Right, because people don't just abandon their ancestral homes on a whim.
They absolutely do not.
Yeah.
I mean, we often imagine historical poverty as this static, unchanging condition. But the push factors detailed in this report, they were born out of a massive demographic and economic upheaval.
Like a total system shock.
Exactly. Europe was experiencing this staggering population boom. Due to better diets and early medicine, mortality rates were plummeting.
Which sounds like a good thing.
It is, but populations were surging while the amount of cultivable land remained exactly the same.
So the math just stops working.
Precisely.
The report highlights Norway specifically for this. It paints this picture of incredibly narrow valleys and fjord farms.
Yeah.
And you have families trying to subdivide an already tiny plot of land among like four or five surviving
Yeah,
children.
you can only slice a pie so many times.
Right. And eventually you generate this massive class of landless laborers. The report calls them cotters.
The cotter class, yeah.
These were people who literally had zero prospect of ever owning the ground they stood on, no matter how hard they worked.
And then you add to that the structural changes happening across the region. The report spends a lot of time analyzing a process called enclosure in Sweden, which violently disrupted traditional life.
Wait, let me stop you there. When the report says enclosure, is that the literal fencing off of communal farmland?
It is.
So families who had, grazed livestock or foraged for centuries in these shared woods suddenly had zero access to that land.
That is the exact mechanism, yeah.
Yeah.
Wealthier landowners basically consolidated these small, fragmented communal strips into massive, commercialized farms.
Wow.
So the traditional village structure was physically dismantled to make way for capitalist agriculture. And meanwhile, Denmark was undergoing this incredibly painful transition to a market economy.
Just bad news all around.
Yeah, you have bad harvests, livestock diseases, collapsing grain prices. The household risk just became unmanageable. So migrating to America wasn't some romantic adventure. It was a cold, rational family survival strategy.
And they're looking at America right as the United States is pulling every lever possible to import human capital. I mean, the pull factors were just overwhelming.
Oh, absolutely.
You have the 1862 Homestead Act offering 160 acres of land for just a nominal filing fee. Railroads are laying track across the continent and desperately need bodies to do the heavy lifting.
They were desperate for labor.
Right. You even have American mining companies and lumber camps actively sending recruiters to European ports.
Straight to the docks.
Yeah. But the sheer mechanics of getting from a tiny Swedish village to a specific plot of land in Minnesota, that is what I found completely mind-blowing in this report. I mean, think of chain migration like an algorithm designed to remove friction.
How do you mean? Like a modern algorithm?
Yeah, like an early 19th century social network algorithm. So the very first pioneer in a family or a village takes on 100% of the risk. They make the terrifying ocean crossing. They figure out how the bizarre American land office works. They find a decent job.
Right, they do all the heavy lifting.
Exactly. But then they send back a letter. They send a prepaid steamship ticket. And suddenly, the transaction cost for the next family drops to near zero.
That makes total sense.
You aren't stepping into the terrifying unknown anymore. You're stepping onto a boat knowing your cousin is waiting at the docks in Chicago to hand you a job.
What's fascinating here is how effectively those networks built what sociologists call social infrastructure.
Social infrastructure.
Yeah. We tend to view old ethnic churches or mutual aid societies as just cultural clubs. You know, places to sing hymns from the old country or eat traditional foods.
It's community centers.
Right. But the data shows they were actually ruthless survival mechanisms. Mm. A Midwestern Lutheran congregation in, say, 1880 functioned as a bank giving out credit.
Wow.
It was a real estate agency helping you find a farm. It was an employment office. It was even a marriage market, all rolled into one.
And the ethnic newspapers, too. The report mentions they were printing shipping schedules, translating confusing American property laws, and even warning new arrivals about fraudulent land agents.
They had to protect their own.
Yeah. The community itself became an institution that shielded you from the absolute chaos of 19th century capitalism.
Completely.
But this algorithm didn't just produce one giant, monolithic Scandinavian America. It sorted people with shocking precision, depending on whether they were Norwegian, Swedish, or Danish. Let's look at how they carved out totally distinct economic niches.
Yeah, the sorting is incredible. The Norwegian data, for example, shows the highest level of rural geographic concentration among the three groups.
Okay.
They heavily settled in Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, and the Dakotas, focusing intensely on grain and dairy farming. They really tied themselves to the land. But interestingly, they also tied themselves to the sea.
Yes. This was one of the most vivid parts of the source material for me. You see these Norwegian networks dominating commercial fishing and maritime trades, and not just on the Great Lakes in Duluth, but way out in the Pacific Northwest.
Right, all the way across the country.
In Seattle, Norwegian immigrants essentially built the commercial halibut fishery from scratch. We are talking about massive communities in neighborhoods like Ballard, where they were the shipbuilders, the captains, the cannery workers.
It was a complete monopoly on that industry.
So the Norwegians tied themselves to the land and sea. But if I'm looking at this data right, the Swedes took a completely different gamble. They bet on the American industrial machine.
They did. The Swedes were much more occupationally diverse. They certainly farmed the plains, particularly in Nebraska and Minnesota. But they formed massive urban industrial communities.
Like in Chicago.
Exactly. Chicago became the undisputed Swedish-American metropolis. By 1900, Chicago had more Swedes than any city in the world except Stockholm.
That is an insane statistic.
It really is. You had Swedish construction firms building the city's infrastructure, massive labor forces in the factories, and really intricate political organizations.
And the report highlights Rockford, Illinois as well. It became this major hub for Swedish manufacturing, specifically for furniture and metalworking.
Oh, yeah. Very organized labor there.
They built this highly visible, incredibly organized, working-class industrial culture. So we have Norwegians as rural and maritime, Swedes as a mix of farming and heavy urban industrial, and then we have the Danes.
The smallest group.
Right. The report notes they were the smallest and most dispersed group, famous for dairy farming in places like Iowa and Nebraska, which actually brings me back to that wild statistic from the very beginning of our deep dive.
The Utah connection.
Yes. Hold on. I'm looking at the Danish numbers in this report, and this still baffles me. How does a Midwestern dairy farming demographic end up establishing their highest modern concentration in Salt Lake City?
Well, the mechanism there is entirely different from the Midwestern story. The Danish migration to Utah was part of a highly specific religious pipeline.
A religious pipeline, okay.
Yeah, in the mid-19th century, the Latter-day Saint Church sent missionaries to Denmark, which had actually just established a new constitution granting religious freedom.
Oh, timing is everything.
Exactly. Yeah. And the converts didn't use the standard secular land agents or railroad tickets. They migrated through heavily organized church networks, using things like the Perpetual Emigrating Fund, which funneled them directly to the Intermountain West.
So they bypassed the Midwestern Lutheran farm colonies completely?
Completely bypassed them. It was a religiously motivated migration system settling places like Cache, Box Elder, and Utah counties. It perfectly illustrates how an immigrant's final destination was almost entirely dictated by the specific network they tapped into back in Europe.
Man, these networks are fascinating. But, you know, they didn't just drop these immigrants onto an empty game board.
No, they certainly did not.
And the report takes a very unvarnished look at how this settlement actually happened. Just as a quick note for you listening, whenever we hit politically charged historical topics, we are impartially reporting the sociological findings of the source material. We take no sides. We're just giving you the facts as presented in the report.
Right. Our goal is just to convey the research.
Exactly. So the report points out that the success of the 1862 Homestead Act, the very thing that allowed hundreds of thousands of Scandinavian families to thrive, was historically and legally contingent on the forced removal and reservation confinement of indigenous nations.
Yeah.
We are talking about the Dakota, the Ojibwe, the Ho-Chunk, among others.
And the sociological data in the report frames this as a complex dual reality.
Yeah.
On one hand, you have immigrants fleeing crushing poverty and achieving incredible upward mobility through backbreaking labor.
Right. They worked incredibly hard.
They did. But on the other hand, they are directly participating in a settler colonial system.
Hmm.
The source material cites the U.S. Dakota War of 1862 as absolutely central to the settlement geography of Minnesota.
How so?
Well, state violence and federal treaties essentially transferred indigenous homelands into the private property markets that Scandinavian immigrants then purchased or claimed.
Wow. The source material also goes deep into the mechanics of something called racial incorporation. I want to make sure we unpack that clearly because it explains so much of the political map later on.
It's a key concept here.
Yeah, because the immigrants faced intense ethnic stereotyping when they arrived. People mocked their accents. They were given the most brutal, dangerous labor in the mines and lumber camps. But legally, they were incorporated into whiteness.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, that legal classification was the ultimate key to their upward mobility.
Because of what it unlocked.
Exactly. Being legally classified as white gave Scandinavian immigrants access to naturalization, the right to vote, and the ability to claim federal land under the Homestead Act.
Which wasn't available to everyone.
Not at all. The report explicitly contrasts this with the structural constraints placed on other groups at the exact same time. African Americans were facing Jim Crow segregation, Asian immigrants were being actively barred by exclusion laws, and indigenous peoples were subjected to forced assimilation policies.
So the success of the Scandinavian diaspora was this mix of genuine, grueling immigrant achievement, but also the product of unequal state structures that legally permitted them to accumulate wealth while barring others.
That's exactly what the data shows.
And speaking of state structures, that brings us to the political legacy of these regions today, because there is this modern stereotype that places heavily settled by Scandinavians, like Minnesota or the Dakotas, are just naturally progressive.
Right. Like it's in their blood.
Yeah. Like they imported a welfare state mentality directly in their DNA from the old country.
Well, the report completely dismantles the idea of a genetic Nordic trait for progressive politics.
Mm.
When you look at the historical data, the radical politics that emerged from these areas, movements like the Nonpartisan League in North Dakota or the Farmer Labor Party in Minnesota, they were born out of raw, brutal economic survival.
Yeah, if you've ever driven through the Dakotas on a road trip and wondered why there are so many massive community-owned grain elevators or local credit unions, this is why.
It wasn't imported European culture.
No. It was a 19th century defense mechanism against American monopolies.
Right. The farmers were being financially squeezed by railroad monopolies, eastern banks, and grain traders who just mercilessly dictated the prices of their crops.
They were trapped.
So they organized. They built cooperative creameries and grain elevators to completely bypass the middlemen. And this is actually where the Finnish immigrants we mentioned earlier come into play.
Oh, right.
In the mining regions of the Iron Range and the Pacific Northwest lumber camps, Finnish immigrants became the vanguard of radical labor organizing. They partnered with Swedish and Norwegian workers in cities like Chicago and Milwaukee to join unions and socialist parties, fighting unsafe, exploitative industrial conditions.
So it was the institutional context of the American frontier and industrial cities that caused this. If you're a farmer getting price gouged by a railroad or a miner watching your friends get injured due to unsafe conditions, you unionize or form a co-op out of absolute necessity.
You're trying to survive capitalism.
Exactly. You are trying to survive. The report even notes that these exact same communities could pivot and support prohibition, nativist movements, or conservative republicanism, depending on the decade and their specific class position at the time.
Yeah, they used the literacy, the local township government experience, and the congregational trust they had built in their churches to form political coalitions based on shared grievances.
It was totally pragmatic.
It was a reaction to American economic conditions, not a prepackaged ideology imported from 19th century Europe.
So all of this rich, turbulent history, the farming, the maritime networks, the labor strikes, the complex racial dynamics, it has all left a permanent demographic fingerprint. And here's where it gets really interesting, looking at the 2024 American Community Survey numbers today.
The modern data is fascinating.
When we look at the concentration of Scandinavian ancestry, North Dakota is off the charts. The state has a 24.4% reporting index. Minnesota is right behind at 19.6%.
Very concentrated.
And when you zoom into specific counties, it's wild. Pennington County, Minnesota is over 41% Scandinavian ancestry. Fargo, North Dakota is near 30%.
The percentage concentrations map those historical roots beautifully. But if we look at the absolute headcount, the data tells a totally different story about internal American migration.
How so?
Well, Minnesota still leads the nation in total numbers, with over 1.1 million ancestry mentions. But the state in second place is California, with nearly 759,000.
Wow, California.
Yeah. Washington State, Wisconsin, Illinois, Texas, and Florida all have massive populations of people claiming Scandinavian descent.
Chicago is a perfect example of this shift. We talked earlier about it being a vital historical gateway and a massive industrial hub for Swedes.
Right, second only to Stockholm.
Today, Chicago only has a 1.7% concentration. But because of the city's sheer size, that still represents over 46,000 people.
It just shows how incredibly mobile people are.
Yeah, the children and grandchildren of those prairie farmers and Chicago metal workers eventually packed up and moved to Los Angeles, Seattle, or Dallas for new jobs and new climates. But as they dispersed, the actual nature of their identity fundamentally transformed. The report talks a lot about the shift to symbolic ethnicity. How does the source material define that transition?
Well, for the first and second generations, being Norwegian or Swedish was an everyday survival system. It dictated what language you spoke in your kitchen, where you worked, who you married, and where you worshipped.
It was your whole life.
Exactly. But as the language faded, especially heavily after World War I, when Americanization campaigns really pressured immigrants to drop their native tongues, and as intermarriage with other groups increased, those rigid boundaries softened.
Makes sense.
Today, it has shifted into a symbolic public performance.
Like, it becomes about genealogy, visiting heritage museums, making lefts or lutefisk at Christmas.
Celebrating Sitten Mai in the spring.
Right. It becomes elective. You can be a mix of Swedish, German, and Irish, and you just choose which heritage to highlight on a given day based on what feels meaningful to you.
It's a transition from ethnicity as an organizing principle of life to ethnicity as heritage and memory.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that the 2024 American Community Survey still picks up these massive concentrations in the upper Midwest shows just how durable that memory is, even when the original immigrant neighborhoods are long gone and the languages are no longer spoken in the streets.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? We've covered a massive amount of ground today. We saw that Scandinavian America was never just a single transplanted colony.
Not at all.
It was this incredibly layered system. You had different national streams, Norwegians on the water in the wheat fields, Swedes in the factories of Chicago, Danes building dairy farms and migrating through religious pipelines to the Utah Mountains.
And we saw how this migration intersected in very complicated ways with America's history of colonial expansion and racial classification.
Yeah. And we saw how raw economic survival shaped the famous political legacies of the Midwest, ultimately producing a nationwide symbolic diaspora we see in the 2024 census.
This raises an important question, though, if we look toward the future. The 2024 data clearly shows that ancestry reporting is highly overlapping now. People are claiming Swedish and German or Norwegian and Irish.
Right. It's all mixing.
So if ancestry is becoming purely elective, and the biological or direct linguistic ties continue to thin out over the next few generations, what actually happens to these regional identities?
That's a great question.
Will the Upper Midwest's Scandinavian identity eventually become just a geographic brand, a brand completely divorced from actual demographics, where anyone who moves to Minnesota or North Dakota effectively adopts a Nordic cultural identity just by participating in the local civic life?
Oh, man, that is a fascinating thought. that the culture becomes so baked into the soil that it belongs to the geography itself rather than the DNA of the people living there. Well, as you go about your week, whether you're driving past a cooperative grain elevator, walking through an old industrial district, or just looking at the names on the street signs in your neighborhood, I encourage you to look closer. Because the echoes of the migration blueprints we unpacked today are quite literally all around you, hiding in plain sight. They are the map you walk on every day. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you on the next deep dive.